Good morning, everyone. I'm Asha Nayaswamy. Many of you might have been expecting Shanti because on Friday she usually takes this slot, but she wasn't able to make it today. She's fine, but she has something else she just had to take care of. So I have the privilege of replacing her today. I hope you're not disappointed. She will be back. Let's start with a prayer. Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, Friend, beloved God, Jesus Christ, Babaji Krishna, Lahiri Mahashaya, Swami Sri Yukteswar, beloved Master Paramahansa Yogananda, saints of all religions, dearest friend Swami Kriyananda, humbly we bow at thy feet. We are your children, making our way through this world as best we are able. Illuminate the path. Whisper in our hearts and minds. Take us by the hand as needed and guide us firmly in thy footsteps to thy holy home of bliss. Om. Peace. Amen. I am going to pull a little section out of this book, Light Bearer, which I hold up every chance I get, which is this book I wrote about 45 years of life with Swami year by year. This is from 1974. Many of you have heard me talk about this book before, but just to remind you, Swamiji told me that I should write a book about him when I was, I believe when I was 24, right around that time, which would have been 1971. It was right at the very beginning. I already knew, as I put in the introduction to this book, that what I was experiencing was not to be kept with me, but that I was a witness, and then I would have to testify about who he was and what I was seeing. So from very early on, I started taking notes. But I'm conscientious but not systematic is actually how I would describe myself. So I took notes on little pieces of paper in notebooks. I would type things up later. I saved every document that was related to my life with Swami, you know, printed material, letters he wrote to me, notes I wrote to him, and I just put it all into a drawer. It went on for a number of decades and just, you know, was this huge heap. When it was finally made clear to me that I really needed to work on this, which was about 2003, I spent literally a year and a half just going through and copying and reading and sorting and cross-referencing. And I use a computer all the time, but I still can't think clearly if it's only on the screen. I can't flip from file to file and make sense out of things. I'm tactile. I have to have it in my hand. So I made enormous paper files, which my younger friends thought was just ridiculous, but it was the only way I could do it. And I wrote this book from boxes and boxes of paper files. And so I had both chronological and subject files, cross-references with a lot of duplicate. And as I wrote this book over the course of several years, mostly I had to be in seclusion, I would essentially reconstruct every year. And I tried. Yesterday when I was speaking, I realized that I had put into 1994 something that I'm sure happened, was talked about much earlier. And I had thought that I'd been pretty strictly loyal to chronology because I felt that it would be more interesting for the reader if the ideas and understandings that Swamiji was sharing with me came to the reader sequentially as they'd come to me. With that exception of what I did yesterday, which is an anomaly, I think, in the book, mostly I did things sequentially. So what happens in this particular section of 1974 happened in 1974. And when I was working with all those notes, I have a good memory. Of course, I didn't remember by any means everything that was in those notes, but most of the time when I would read something, it would trigger my memory. And not only would I read it there, but I could remember when it happened. Of course, not always. But there were countless treasures within those files that were not at the top of my mind. And many things I discovered, the magnitude of it was wonderful to me. So what I'm going to work with today, and actually probably for several days, because I don't think it's possible for me to, I mean, it's definitely not possible for me to do this in one session, and whether it's going to take actually six sessions or not remains to be seen. In the early years of Ananda Swami, we had a newsletter which was called The Banyan Tree. And it was published monthly, quarterly, or whenever we can afford to print it, which was pretty much exactly, I mean, and afford to print it. In those days, you had to both print it physically and mail it. We had our own little ditto machine, is what we used to call them. There you go. It was a Gestetner. It was a little copier machine. You know, Xerox had yet to be invented. So that wasn't expensive, but it was the postage that cost. And it was called the Banyan Tree, because the banyan tree comes from one central root, and then what happens is the branches fall and make another root, and then another root, and another root. So you can literally have one banyan tree that covers a whole acre, and each of the branches have created its own root and its own tree. Truth, like the banyan tree, truth is one, but its branches are many. And that was, so Swami called it the banyan tree, this newsletter, and he personally wrote it. You know, there were a lot of us hanging around Swamiji, but for many years, it was really a one-man show because we were all such novices. It took time before any of us had sufficient understanding to be able to present the teachings on our own. Jyotish, from the very beginning, but he came to Swamiji, I think, in 1964 or 65. So, and Jyotish was a spokesperson and a minister and a teacher for Ananda almost from the very beginning. And a few others. Swami gave those positions. But nonetheless, the vision was really coming from Master through him. So in 1974, in one of the editions of the Banyan Tree, Swamiji was always caught between these two realities, and it actually lasted to the end of his life, which is Ananda itself is a unique expression of Paramahansa Yogananda's ray. Swamiji himself is a disciple of Master, was a clear window for the vibration of Yogananda. Master himself never claimed to be representing anything other than God and gurus. And Master himself gave the credit he turned to Sri Yukteswar and to Babaji as the source of what he was doing. So every individual window truly understood was just the frame through which the same sunlight was shining. But human nature being what it is, and this world being what it is, there's a natural tendency to particularize the ray according to the window through which we're viewing it. And Swamiji made a continuous effort to universalize the experience, to give appropriate, in fact, absolute devotion to Master as the source, but to recognize that what was coming through him was principles. And so he was often trying to turn Ananda from an organization into a movement or into a ray of grace. And he found countless different ways over the years to try to get that point across to us. And in 1974, in the Banyan Tree, he was trying to launch the Ananda Cooperative Communities Movement. And at that time, we were trying to interface with, there were a number of other communities in the 70s, different groups of people going back to the land. Yesterday, I was referring to the Native American influence on America today, the Native American influence on a lot of what we were doing starting in the 70s. In the context I was talking yesterday, I was talking about actually a lot of the hippies and the baby boomers in the 70s who were doing unusual things back to the land was because we were, in fact, reincarnated Native Americans who, as Swami put it, had our land stolen from us and were now rich enough to buy it back. And so there was a lot of that going on. And we were trying to make alliances with many of these communities because we had a lot in common with them. But at the same time, we had a lot not in common with them. And a lot of the ideals that others were working for, valid in themselves, were not entirely consistent with the principles upon which we stood. So Swamiji felt the need to create an Ananda Communities movement that would reflect, as he put it, the basic principles of Master's teachings. So on page 77 of Lightbearer, I quoted from what Swamiji wrote in the Banyan Tree as these six basic principles upon which Ananda has been built. I'm going to read all six of them to you, and then I'm going to go back and talk about them one by one, because they're really about the life of a devotee as we are following it. And I want to put another condition in here. You know, every individual has a snowflake reality, meaning a unique composition based on the unique character of their karma. Some of you have seen the interviews that we've been doing at noon with various of the millennials, including Keshava Betts, who is an astrologer, and he raised the extremely interesting fact that because of this computer program that he has, which can search for astrological combinations backwards in time, he was able to put in, even very broadly, the essential characteristics of his own horoscope, not even in great detail, but in enough detail, and had his computer search literally for hours back thousands of years for when that exact horoscope had appeared before. And going back thousands of years, there was never a moment when exactly that configuration had happened. It was unique to the destiny of him as a jiva, as a unique creation of God, which is all of us. We are all unique creations of God. And equally divine in our true nature. As we say in the festival every week, you know, God's love is equal. It's not just Krishna and Jesus who win it, but even those among us who have sinned most greatly, we are not separate from God. And yet, in that unity, there are countless unique expressions. And as we find our path to God and find our spiritual family and we find our teacher and our teaching, we begin to vibrate in a certain way. And attunement with that vibration is our avenue to salvation. So different families have different characteristics. And even within Master's family, different enclaves, different smaller families within Master's family have different subtleties in their attunement. So that's why Swami wanted to define exactly this is the aspect of Master's work that is our path to salvation, that is the characteristics of our particular attunement. Other equally dedicated disciples could simply pick it up from another string. They would be standing, you might say, on the other side of the diamond, looking into a different facet, and looking into that facet, it would reflect differently. So here are the six principles that Swami wrote, and each has its positive and then its balancing, almost all five of them do. So these are the principles: simplicity, but not primitivism; world compassion, not world rejection; practicality, not utopianism; service, not self-indulgence; love of God, not materialism; and finally, kindness, respect, and an open heart to all. Now, obviously, any true devotee would not reject most of these, but even as I'm going to go through this, you can see it creates a specific nature of life. Again, this is page 77 in this book if you're interested. So let's start with simplicity. one of Master's mottos, well, in several different ways, several different places, Master begins to talk about the concept of simplicity. Even in his exhortation to the founding, for the founding of communities, which he declared at a garden party in Beverly Hills, it was 1948 or 1949, if I'm not mistaken, which Swamiji heard as a clarion call to action for the founding of these communities. You see, this is how Swamiji took Master's ray and uniquely allowed it to flow through his particular configuration. Cooperative communities was an ideal that Swami Kriyananda had before he met Master. When he was 15 years old and World War II was raging in Europe, Swamiji contemplated, you know, what is the solution here? And he came up with the idea of cooperative communities based on high ideals, which could exemplify for the world another way of life. Then when he's 22, he comes to Master. He comes to Master for called by God to his guru and is astonished to find out that Master too advocates these cooperative communities based on high ideals. So when Master issued this clarion call, you must go north, thousands of youths must go north, south, east, and west, covering the world with little colonies, demonstrating that plain living and high thinking results in the greatest happiness. And so he was talking about simplifying our lives, bringing them down to the essentials that are necessary to support divine fulfillment and extricating ourselves from unnecessary necessities, as Yogananda called them. But Master did not. He recommended simplicity but not primitivism, because also during the 70s and among many spiritual advocates, there's a desire to turn your back on the whole of the modern world, you know, to just repudiate technology, to repudiate just the complexity that this modern world creates, self-sufficiency with renewable sources of energy, for example, can be an aspect of simplicity, but to repudiate for the sake of repudiation was not what Master suggested. Master also said, for example, that St. Francis of Assisi was his patron saint, and he was deeply inspired by Francis. And Francis's life was more than simple. Francis embraced intense austerity, you know, going without warm clothes in the winter, eating only the food that was donated to them when they went out begging, having no permanent dwelling places, going barefoot in sandals, even in snowy weather. I have stayed at the place called Laverna, where St. Francis went into seclusion, and it was there he received the marks of Christ on his body, the stigmata. I visited there, in the month of November, which is not even the deepest part of winter, and it was bone-chillingly cold when I was wrapped up in modern warm clothes. It was, and then I sat in this little cave where, this stone underground cave where Francis often meditated, and it was, again, bone-chillingly cold, and I was wrapped up for the weather, and I thought, what world transcendence this man had to be able not only to endure, but to thrive and to lift his mind totally above the body. Now, Master did not recommend this. Master lived in Los Angeles. He developed a beautiful ashram in Los Angeles. He developed various other places where he also lived. So, and he himself said, Francis was devoted to Lady Poverty. He said, I am devoted to Lady Simplicity. Now, in the 1970s, when I was living in the same community with Swami Kriyananda, the way he lived, and this was confusing for some people there, was bigger than the way the most of the rest of us lived, bigger in these senses. I lived in a trailer, which I absolutely loved. A trailer was like travel trailers, what they used to call these very small trailers that you could hook up even to the back of a car and pull somewhere. I mean, those of you who are much younger, I think such things hardly exist. Now there's vans and, converted vans, and the VW camper van was the first sort of its type that the hippies all adapted. But these little travel trailers, it was, I don't know how many feet long, but I had a place where I could sit to meditate. And this was sequentially from the back. A place that was wide enough for me to sit to meditate. A place where I had a narrow single bed. A place where I had a butane burner, like a camping stove, not quite. There was a small sink, although I didn't have running water. I just had a sink so that I could pour water down the drain and it would go out a pipe. Then I had a small table where I could sit. So that was the entire length of my trailer. The width was slightly wider than the extension of my arms, and the height was I couldn't quite raise my arm. So if I wanted to energize, we all developed the habit of energizing like that instead of being able to lift our hand all the way to the top. It was absolutely perfect. I absolutely loved it. I had a wonderful gas heater. I was quite warm in there. I could cook. I could cook like that. No refrigeration, no electricity, kerosene lighting. I absolutely loved it. I like to think I could go back and live that way again. No indoor plumbing, just an outhouse not very far away. There was a standing pipe for water right nearby. I took bucket baths for a decade and never thought anything about it. Hot water, heat, the ability to cook. Those were my bottom lines. But Swamiji had a dome, and that dome was large enough for 30 or 40 people to gather in that dome. It's still the center point of Crystal Hermitage. At that time, it was very primitive. He did not have electricity, but he did have a generator. He had a large space. He had a full kitchen. He had a refrigerator. He could have electricity whenever he wanted it. He had a separate, his dome was divided, living room, sleeping loft, study, full kitchen. He had a car. He traveled. He bought equipment when he needed it, recording equipment, computer to write with, and so on like that. All of which was just totally beyond my means. And some people who didn't understand thought, that somehow he was taking advantage of the rest of us. But what Swami was doing, that was simple living for him, because what he had was exactly what he needed to carry on his assignment from Master. His assignment from Master was to start a community. He had to have satsangs. He needed to be able to greet guests. He needed to be able to bring the community over and talk to us. He needed to be able to reach beyond the physical bounds of the community by getting in a car and driving to other cities. From time to time, he needed to travel to Europe. He needed to be able to write books. And to write books, when he needed at least an electric typewriter, which he had, and then later got a computer to write with, he needed to be able to work all night, so he had to have a generator to make that work. But there was no luxury in that life. Luxury defined by something you have just to have it, not because you actually need it. Now, you see, that becomes an interesting thing. What do we actually need? And how do we define our needs? I had everything I needed. I had absolutely everything I needed. I had a harmonium. I had a mala. I actually had a standard typewriter, which I needed. Later on, I got electricity and I got an electric typewriter. When I myself advanced to the point where the standard typewriter was a limitation to my ability to express the Dharma that God had given me. So what Swami did is whenever he hit the edge of what was the edge of his needing to be able to express the Dharma that God had given him, he generated the magnetism to expand into whatever that request was. So gradually, Crystal Hermitage, the house he lived in, was expanded. Eventually, electricity was brought into it. Eventually, He personally raised the money to build a whole recording studio right there as part of Crystal Hermitage, because the potential of both audio and video raised the possibility of his carrying out his dharma. So by then, he's living in a larger place that has more amenities than the place that I have. He eventually builds a kitchen where we can cook meals for really up to 100 people, where Swami can now have large occasions in his own home. So how do you define that, whether that's simple living or not? But none of it was ever for self-indulgence, and none of it was ever more than he needed. And then at a certain point, he explained to us that if people are going to, this is how he put it. Well, it came to him first like this. He had this car that he'd paid $50 for on an auction. It was a government surplus materials auction, and he bought this Chevrolet. Pretty sure he paid $50, maybe $75 for it. They actually bought two of the same car for $75 each, as I recall. One for Swami to drive and one to use for parts to keep the other one running. And it had been an Air Force car, and they'd painted over it. You could still see the word Air Force. So, of course, we called it Air Force One, even though it was just this old Chevrolet. And it operated really well. It was kept in really good running order. Had a huge trunk, and it could hold six of us, so we all got to travel. At least five got to travel with Swami, or four, which was really terrific for us. And we went to a big event in San Francisco where many other spiritual teachers were present. We arrived slightly late, and as we were looking for a parking place, we saw Cadillacs, we saw brand new late model cars, we saw a couple of limousines, we actually saw a couple of Rolls Royces, and we pulled up in our Air Force One, our $50 Army surplus car. Now, it's possible that it was Air Force One that Swami was driving by that point. He also drove a borrowed VW Bug sometime, but this was Air Force One. And after we parked the car and went inside, as we were walking, Swami said, "I have to get a new car." And he said, in India, they would respect me for driving a car this old and this inexpensive. He said, in America, where money is so easy to come by, if I appear to be this impoverished, people will think there's something wrong with the teachings. Isn't that an interesting thing? And Swami eventually bought himself either a new Ford or a new Chevrolet. I'm not quite sure which he did. Kind of a chameleon kind of car. It was comfortable. It was comfortable. Swami had a lot of trouble with his hips. It had to be comfortable. It wasn't old. Swami actually found a different car, more comfortable, and comfort was a big issue because he had arthritis in his hips. But he said it was, how did he put it? It was advertised, it was sold as a luxury car. And he said in the advertisements, all the people that they used to sell this car looked so materialistic. Swami said he didn't want to be part of that aura. He didn't want to be part of that image. So he bought this other car instead. But then he began to tell us that even the way we were living, he said, would make people think, because America is so comfortable, because money is easier to come by, he said we needed to create an atmosphere that was as refined as our ideas so that people would listen to us. And for a lot of us who were actually more dedicated to primitivism than to simplicity. This was our Native American roots and our Himalayan cave roots. Swamiji had to actually, force is sort of the word, persuade us that it was not a betrayal of our ideas to rise from poverty to simplicity, but that it was actually a fulfillment of the assignment Master had given us. Now, I knew I wouldn't be able to get very far, so that is part one, and we'll continue on Monday with the rest of this story. God bless you.